Excited Utterance, the Evidence and Proof Podcast, episode 153, Will Ortman, Confession and Confrontation. Welcome to Excited Utterance. I'm your host, Alex Nunn, from the Texas A&M University School of Law. Excited Utterance is your podcast for cutting-edge scholarship and developments in the world of evidence and proof. We bring virtual workshops to you throughout the academic year. Joining me today on Excited Utterance is Will Ortman, an associate professor of law at Wayne State University Law School. Now, for those kind of well-versed in the history of the Excited Utterance podcast, you'll remember that Will Ortman is actually a returning guest on our show. All the way back in our very first season of Excited Utterance, and I think what was the fourth episode ever, Will joined us to discuss the article that he was working on at the time entitled Confrontation in the Age of Plea Bargaining. Will is back on the podcast today to discuss his new article entitled Confession and Confrontation, which is forthcoming in the California Law Review. In his article, Will takes a look at confessions, and specifically false confession, asking whether, due to the fact that existing constitutional safeguards are somewhat insufficient to protect against false confessions, whether we can turn to the Confrontation Clause as a protection for defendants aiming to exclude a false confession. Will's article is fantastic, and it has huge practical significance. This very issue has come up multiple times in my classroom, and I imagine it will have immense applicability across the nation for many criminal defendants. My conversation with Will today does not disappoint. I was fascinated by what he had to say about confessions and the Confrontation Clause, and I hope you enjoy listening as well. Will, welcome back to Excited Utterance.
Thanks. It is great to be back.
So today we're talking about confessions and specifically false confessions. Obviously a hugely important topic and a lot to discuss today. But before we kind of dive in for a substantive conversation, I want to begin with just an initial question that I like to ask a lot of my guests. Will, what led you to focus on confessions in this project?
Great. So I actually came at this from the confrontation side rather than from the confession side. So I teach Crawford at least once, often twice a year, and I've also written about it. And so over the years, I have read the Crawford decision probably dozens of times. And on reading 43 or 52 or something, I noticed something that I hadn't thought about before, which is we have this idea that somebody's a witness, and we'll get into the details later, but somebody's a witness if they've made a testimonial statement out of court that the prosecutor wants to use. And it occurred to me, well, why doesn't that apply to a defendant's statement as well? So I do what I do when I have a random thought like that. I jotted it down on a piece of paper and I threw it into my ideas drawer, but it kept gnawing on me. And that's often a signal that it's something I want to write about. And so eventually I started really exploring how the Confrontation Clause intersects or could intersect with self-incrimination and with due process. And what I realized when I did that was that there's this kind of gap in our confessions law, our constitutional confessions law, about reliability. We don't really have a constitutional doctrine that focuses on the reliability of confessions. And it occurred to me that that's a gap that the Confrontation Clause, at least after Crawford, could fill. And so once I had both technical argument about Crawford and also a reason why it mattered, I decided that this was something I wanted to get into.
Well, I was thrilled to see this paper because it's such a relatable story. I know multiple times in class I've been confronted with the same question about, hey, what about the defendant's own statements? How does that pair with the Confrontation Clause? And we almost assume it away at times, the Confrontation Clause, that is. But your paper really does the deep dive, and so I can't wait to jump into it. So let's begin with just kind of a foundational background level. Remind me, Will, what constitutional safeguards currently exist to ensure that confessions are not compelled or coerced?
So we have two constitutional doctrines that are sort of in that ballpark, in that neighborhood. So one is the very famous Miranda doctrine, right? And so the Miranda rule says that not only do you have a right not to talk to the police, but you also have a right for the police to warn you about that right before they interview in a custodial setting. And the idea initially was that that was going to be a constraint or a curb on some of the psychologically manipulative tactics that are used in interrogation. We can talk later about whether it's worked out that way. And then the other doctrine is the voluntariness requirement of the due process clause. So the idea there is that if government agents do something that overbears the suspect's will, that's going to render a confession involuntary and thus inadmissible at trial.
And Will, I'm a little bit scared to even ask this next question, but are those constitutional safeguards effective? And what I mean by this is, practically speaking, at the ground level, have they successfully prevented a majority or even a vast majority of false confessions?
So let me take the two doctrines separately. So for the Miranda doctrine, I'm going to give you a clear answer, which is that no, I don't think that the Miranda doctrine is effective, really almost regardless of how you define effective. And that's because it has a very, very broad waiver idea. So long as the police give the warning and the person says, yeah, I'll talk to you anyway, Miranda's done, right? It doesn't concern itself with what happens next. And all the important stuff ordinarily is what happens next. And so the waiver rule has sort of undone whatever capacity Miranda might have had to regulate interrogations and confessions. Now, with due process voluntariness, it's a little bit more complicated. And I think that in some sense, it depends on what we're looking for to be effective in doing. So the way that the Supreme Court explains it, the point of the voluntariness requirement, the point of due process in the interrogation context, isn't directly about reliability at all. It's about avoiding government misconduct. It's about avoiding sort of the worst interrogation practices that you might think about. Does it do that? Well, I'm sure that it does in some respect. We don't have the third degree anymore, at least not in any sort of large way. But if the question is whether it prevents false confessions, well, that's tricky. I don't think we can actually answer that in an empirically satisfying way, because we just don't know which confessions are false and which are true. That's sort of unknowable in a real world setting. So we kind of have to look for clues. We have to look for circumstantial evidence. And I think that the circumstantial evidence that we have suggests the voluntariness is just not a good way of ensuring that confessions that are introduced in criminal trials are reliable. So a couple of pieces of circumstantial evidence. One is the role that false confessions have played in cases where somebody has been exonerated by DNA. So there are lots of cases, dozens of cases, where somebody has confessed and they've either gone to trial and been found guilty or they've pled guilty. And then later, DNA evidence has come in to exonerate them, to clear them from guilt. And so we know with a lot of confidence that false confessions do happen. Obviously, that doesn't tell us anything about how often they happen. But the second piece of circumstantial evidence is I think, pretty suggestive. That comes from experimental results in studies that social psychologists have done. So while we can't know in real-world settings whether a confession is true or false, at least not ordinarily, we can know that in the sort of artificial setting of a laboratory. And so what social psychologists find when they run an experiment and somebody is falsely accused of cheating on the experiment or not following the experiment's directions or something like that, is that the kinds of tactics that law enforcement routinely use are actually really effective in producing false confessions. True confessions too, but false confessions alongside them. And those tactics are well within the bounds of what the due process voluntariness requirement permits, at least ordinarily they are. So I think while that doesn't prove anything, among other issues, the artificial setting of a psychological experiment is never going to match the real world context of a police interrogation. But I think it's pretty suggestive of the idea. It's evidence of the idea, the way that interrogation is routinely done can easily produce a false confession.
Perfect. So to address these problems then that you've identified, these constitutional shortcomings, your paper actually turns to a different constitutional provision, namely the Sixth Amendment's Confrontation Clause. So for us evidence professors and the evidence professors out there listening, we'll have some background already in the Confrontation Clause. But for listeners who might not be familiar, remind us in general terms, what does the Confrontation Clause protect?
The Confrontation Clause says that a defendant gets to confront, which really just means cross-examine the government's witnesses. So that has a couple of different implications. So one thing it means is that when a prosecutor calls a witness in court to testify against a defendant, the witness doesn't get to just leave after the prosecutor's done asking her questions. The defendant, specifically the defendant's lawyer, gets to ask questions of her own. But it also has implications for people who make out-of-court accusations against a defendant. So in probably the Supreme Court's most famous Confrontation Clause case of all time, Crawford versus Washington, the court said that when somebody makes a testimonial, we come back to what that means, out-of-court accusation against a criminal defendant, and then the prosecutor is going to use that statement at trial, that person is also a government witness, which means that the defendant is entitled to cross-examine them. And if the government can't produce them for cross-examination, then the out-of-court statements can't be used at trial.
So here we're getting close to the core of the argument that you advance in your paper. How does the Confrontation Clause protect against false confessions?
So let me just start by telling you the rule that I'm arguing for, and then we can get into how I get there. The rule that the paper is advocating is that a defendant's confession to the police under interrogation ought to be inadmissible against her unless one of two things happens. So one is if she testifies at trial. And then two is if the police interrogators didn't use any tactics that leveraged either hope or fear to get her to confess. I think when most people first hear that, they think either, well, what are you talking about? Or that doesn't make any sense, or maybe some combination of both of those things. So I know we'll get into the legal argument that I advance, but maybe I should say a couple of words now about why I think that this would be a good idea. And it goes back to what I was really just talking about, which is that I think that there's a real problem with the sort of dominant method of police interrogation that's used in the United States. So the way that most American police officers and law enforcement agents are trained to interrogate is to use pretty clever tactics to induce confessions. So these are, among other things, these are things that either minimize the crime, right, which makes the suspect feel like maybe it's not such a big deal to confess, or things that maximize a crime, right, which make a suspect feel like confessing is the only way to avoid a really terrible consequence. So I talked a little bit about the psychological studies that show that maximization and minimization tactics can produce false confessions. Yet on the other hand, they're mostly legally in bounds under the due process clause. And so I think that's a problem. And the rule that I'm proposing could address that, because the tactics that are concerning are tactics that induce hope or fear. And so part of what I think that this rule might do, if courts took it seriously, is it would give police departments and law enforcement agencies a reason to explore interrogation methods that don't rely on those kinds of tactics. Those methods exist. They're used in other parts of the world, but by and large, they're not used by American law enforcement. So I think that the Confrontation Clause offers a solution to a real problem.
Awesome. So I think that's a super compelling argument. But of course, there's going to be quite a few objections potentially to the thesis that you propose in this project. So let's dive in and explore some of those objections right now. So first, I want to rewind to your legal analysis. Will, does a confession truly make a defendant a quote-unquote witness against herself as required by the Sixth Amendment? Like, what do you think the Crawford Court would say about that argument?
Great. So let me give you two doctrinal answers and then one sort of more practical one. Okay, so first doctrinal answer. Crawford says that somebody becomes a government witness, a witness against a defendant, if they make a testimonial out-of-court statement that the government uses at trial. And I think that applies pretty straightforwardly to a defendant's confession. Right. So what does it mean for something to be testimonial? That's sort of been the perennial question in the 20 years since the court decided Crawford. And there's lots of unanswered questions about what testimonial means at the edges. But the core of it is things that somebody says to a police officer or a detective or a federal agent under formal interrogation, right? In the interrogation room, not in an emergency situation. And that's the setting for lots and lots of confessions. And so then Crawford's exclusionary rule also seems to apply straightforwardly, right? The rule is that the government has to produce the witness, and if the government can't produce the witness for whatever reason, then the out-of-court statement is out. So that's doctrinal reason one, simply the way that the court defined witnesses against a defendant in Crawford. Doctrinal argument two is, sort of responding to an anticipated objection, I don't think there's anything strange or unnatural about conceptualizing a defendant as a potential witness against himself. I think that's actually the central premise of the Fifth Amendment's privilege against self-incrimination, right? The Fifth Amendment says that you can't be compelled to be a witness against yourself. And so the idea that a defendant might, by virtue of things they say out of court, be a witness against themselves, I think that is well within the bounds of how we and how the Bill of Rights thinks about what a witness is. And then the third answer, the more practical one, is confessions are really powerful evidence, right? We actually have constitutional doctrines about that too. Confessions are maybe the most powerful evidence that you can have in a criminal case. They're evidence that it's almost impossible for a jury to pass. So I think not only is a defendant who confessed a witness against themselves, but they're typically the government's best witness.
So we've been looking at the theoretical side of your argument thus far. I want to shift gears ever so slightly and consider some kind of practical consequences or the on-the-ground realities of your proposal. So let's try to play this out. Let's assume that the Confrontation Clause does indeed apply, as you would argue, to a defendant's confession. How would that actually operate at trial, right? We have a defendant's confession. The prosecution wants to introduce the defendant's confession. And so to satisfy the Confrontation Clause, presumably, the prosecution tries to call the defendant. Then what happens?
Okay, right. So typically, all that the Confrontation Clause requires the government to do with respect to somebody who made an out-of-court accusation is bring the person to court. And the thing about a defendant is they're already in court, right? They have to be there. They're required to be there, at least ordinarily. So, right, we can imagine a situation where the prosecutor calls a detective to tell the jury what the defendant said, and the defendant objects and says, this is a Confrontation Clause problem, right? So what's the prosecutor going to do? Prosecutor's going to turn to the defendant and say, okay, fine, then I call you, defendant, to testify. So then the defendant has a choice to make. Is she going to testify? The privilege against self-incrimination means that she doesn't have to. There is a very strong principle that you can't compel a defendant to actually testify at trial. But she might choose to, either when the prosecutor calls her to testify during the government's case or later during the defense case. And so at that point, the confession would come in and the defendant would confront it. It would be what I call self-confrontation, meaning that the defendant would tell the jury all the reasons why they shouldn't credit the confession, right? Explain why the confession was taken out of context, why she was beleaguered during the questions, why she misunderstood the questions, why she felt pressured by the questions, all with the goal of persuading the jury not to give the confession credit. It would be very similar to the way that the defense would interact with any witness who made an out-of-court accusation before trial and then had recanted it by the time of trial. Okay, so obviously, my prediction is most of the time a defendant's not going to do that, right? They're not going to testify. They're going to invoke their right against self-incrimination and stay off the witness stand. So then the question is, well, I mean, can a defendant really invoke both self-incrimination and the Confrontation Clause at the same time with respect to the exact same evidence, their out-of-court statement? Or does invoking one forfeit or waive the other? And I think that the answer to that under the Supreme Court's current law governing waiver and forfeiture is no. There is no waiver. There is no forfeiture. And the reasons get a little bit technical and in the weeds, but just to talk briefly about them, to forfeit or waive the Confrontation Clause, you've got to do something wrongful. And there's nothing about invoking the privilege against self-incrimination that's wrongful. I mean, it deprives the jury of information, but the Constitution gives the defendant the prerogative not to testify. And I don't think you can characterize that as a wrongful act. And then as far as forfeiting or waiving self-incrimination, the thing that the court looks to is whether the defendant has done something that distorts the adversarial process of trial. And I don't think that invoking the Confrontation Clause can be characterized as doing that. So when a defendant elects not to testify, Crawford's exclusionary rule that the confession is out, I think, remains.
So, of course, the Confrontation Clause is not an absolute prohibition, right? It has exceptions, notably for dying declarations. This was footnote 6 of Crawford, and for situations where a declarant is made wrongfully unavailable. So isn't a court just as likely to say that, hey, a defendant's own statements, that's subject to an exception of the Confrontation Clause? What's preventing that path for the jurisprudence?
Right. So that is absolutely the next question, right? So if we get to this point of the analysis, well, then, I mean, isn't a court going to say, all right, so you've got a point about the definition of a witness, you've got a point about forfeiture and waiver, but there just has to be an exception, right, that would allow a defendant's confession to come in. So Crawford didn't just tell us about a couple of exceptions to confrontation, the ones that you just mentioned. It also gave us a framework for thinking about when there can be an exception to the confrontation right. Court says, look to history, right? And so specifically look to the history of the common law as it existed in 1791. And if an out-of-court statement could come in against a defendant without confrontation then, well, then it's going to be okay now as well. So then the question is, well, could a defendant's confession be admitted without confrontation in 1791? The court actually alludes to this in Crawford itself, says that it could, but that is subject to a really, really important caveat. So at common law, at least as it existed in 1791, there was something known as the confessions rule. And the confessions rule said that a suspect's confession could be used against the suspect so long as it was not induced by even the slightest amount of hope or fear. I mean, common law courts in England were really pretty steadfast about enforcing that and rejecting confessions. If there was even a hint that the questions that the person was asked led to the possibility of the suspect experiencing hope or fear and that being the reason for the confession. So is there an exception? Is there room for a confession exception to Crawford? I think absolutely there is, but it's limited, and specifically it's limited because of this history to confessions that are induced without any sort of hope or fear.
All right, well, one last substantive question at least, and I want to get jurisprudential here. Originalism, of course, is the currency of the realm at the Supreme Court today. What do you think an originalist would have to say about applying the Confrontation Clause to a defendant's own confessions?
Great. So you're absolutely right. Originalism is the coin of the realm in today's Supreme Court. I think that there is quite a bit here that originalists might like. So the decision or the argument is based on the court's decision in Crawford. And I think that Crawford is one of the most important criminal procedure originalist decisions of the last 20 or 30 years. Beyond that, the argument takes common law history really seriously, as I was just talking about. It looks to it as a limiting principle on constitutional meaning today. That said, I think that there are things here that might be sticking points for originalists. So let me just talk about a couple of those. So one is, you know, I think an originalist would say, well, nobody in 1791 would have conditioned confession evidence on a defendant's testimony. And that is absolutely, absolutely true, because in 1791, criminal defendants weren't even allowed to testify. There was a disqualification on defendants testifying in 1791. And so it's absolutely the case that it would sound strange to somebody of the founding era to say, well, the confession can come in only if the defendant testifies. Right. So you know, one thing that's changed about the trial since 1791 is that now defendants can testify. Beyond that, we've also lost sight of the confessions rule, right? The rule about confessions induced by hope or fear that I was talking about. And so I think that given all of the changes in the trial process, in the evidentiary rules that surround it, I don't think there's a way to answer how people in 1791 would have understood confessions, the sort of confessions I'm talking about, right? Confessions that were induced by hope or fear, or how that intersects with defendant's testimony, defendant's testifying, or confrontation ideas. So, you know, when the history runs out, I think even an originalist would have to acknowledge that we have to look at other ways of interpreting the Constitution, other ways of sussing out constitutional meaning. And my response to the other originalist objection is actually kind of similar. So I think another originalist objection, more of a public meaning objection, would say, well, look, self-confrontation, that's just not what people understood confrontation, the confrontation right to mean, to include at the founding era. And so I think that I think it's a fair objection. On the other hand, you know, I don't think that there was a single ascertainable confrontation rule at common law that we need to just recover. There were a number of common law practices that today we group under the umbrella of confrontation, right? So one is the principle of cross-examination of people that the government calls to testify at trial. Another is the Crawford point about people whose out-of-court statements are used against defendants. And so I think the confrontation right label, I think that's our term, not the common law term. And so in order to figure out what fits within that umbrella, we have to look at the purposes that the Confrontation Clause is meant to serve. And the central one, not the only one, but the central one is to ensure the reliability of convictions. And I think that the rule that I'm proposing and extending, applying the Confrontation Clause to confessions serves that purpose.
Last question, Will. What's next for the literature here? What type of paper or project could shed additional insight on the issue?
Yeah, so, you know, as a law professor, you put ideas out into the world. You hope that other law professors engage with them. At this point, I think I've said all that I, in this paper, all that I can think of to say about the intersection of confrontation and confessions. I certainly hope that other academics will engage with it, and then I'll have more to say. But really, my big hope here is that the next step for this issue isn't in law reviews or isn't just in law reviews, but that it's in courtrooms. And I hope that defense lawyers in cases where there's a dubious confession will raise the argument in their motions in limine, right, alongside, of course, the more familiar due process arguments. And then I hope that judges will take it seriously.
Awesome. Will, this is such a fantastic paper. As I mentioned to you, I think it's one of the best papers I've read recently, especially on the Confrontation Clause. So thank you so much for chatting with us today.
Well, thanks. This has been a treat.
As I mentioned in my introductory comments, I really love Will's article because first and foremost, it's just expertly crafted. His historical analysis is so insightful. And more than that, the way that he handles potential objections, both objections that are largely anticipated and the objections that I raised during our conversation today, it's just superb. But one thing I really like about this project that isn't true of all evidence projects, including my own projects, absolutely including my own evidence projects, is that Will's project is so eminently practical. The issue that he's encountering and engaging with in his paper, Confession and Confrontation, it comes up all the time. In my classroom, for example, I can't tell you how many times this very question has arisen. A student will raise their hand and ask me, "Well, Professor Nunn, what about if a defendant is objecting under the Confrontation Clause to their own statement? Does the Confrontation Clause apply?" And in that situation, I've always provided just what I thought was the intuitive answer. Of course, the Confrontation Clause won't apply in that context because the defendant can't be a witness against herself. And moreover, the defendant is at trial, and if she wants to, she can take the stand and explain away any problems with her previous statements. But as you saw in our conversation today, and even more so in his paper, Will really takes a hard look at the text of the Sixth Amendment, its original meaning, to really parse out, is that the correct answer? Is it really the case that the Confrontation Clause doesn't apply to a defendant's own statements? And I think, as we discussed today, Will provides a very persuasive rebuttal. So much so that the next time I get that question in the classroom, I'll point the student in Will's direction. Support for Excited Utterance is generously provided by Vanderbilt Law School's Brandstetter Litigation and Dispute Resolution Program and the Texas A&M University School of Law. The producer is Ed Chang, and the production editor is Madeline DiPietro. Additional assistance was provided by Tammy Pierce, and background music is provided by Kirsten Castle Greer, Felix Wong, and Alex Crew. I'm, of course, your host, Alex Nunn, and I hope you will join us again next time when we take on another work in the world of evidence and proof.